If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
The regular season is heating up. New stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks. The most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
Hi, I'm Richard Buskin.
And I'm Robert Rodriguez.
And this is Something About the Beatles.
Not about the song Something, but something or other about the Beatles.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So yeah, we're both authors. We're published authors. I've written about 30 books. How many have you written, Robert?
I think it was 9 or 10 last account, okay, or contributed to. But several have been about the Beatles, which I didn't set out to do, but one sort of led to the other and culminated with the Revolver book last year and this year's Solo in the 70s book.
Yeah, I did a biography of John Lennon. I did a book about Beatles fans. I also did The Complete Idiot's Guide to the Beatles, which some might refer to as A Guide to the Beatles by a Complete Idiot.
You did that memorabilia book too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That was your first masterpiece, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's what the publicist called it anyway.
Right. Something like that.
Yeah. So anyway, giving away something about my age here, you know, I've been a fan of the Beatles since 1963, which for I know a lot of people here in America is almost before the Beatles ever happened.
Yeah, he was in the expensive seats, rattling his jewelry, as I recall.
That's right. I was actually back there this year, believe it or not.
Okay.
Without the jewelry.
Mm-hmm. I can't claim going back that far, but it was really the Red and the Blue albums that were my gateway in the 70s, post-Beatles career, so I didn't really experience them firsthand, but I did catch up in time to kind of pick up on the solo career as it was unfolding in the 1970s and kind of rolled with it ever since.
So what we thought would be really interesting for this first show is to discuss, you know, with the 50th anniversary coming up in 2014 of the Beatles' arrival in the US.
February
the 7th, 64. you're going to hear us trying to outdo each other for trivia here.
Right.
But what we thought would be interesting is also give a perspective of, you know, from the British side, what was happening before they ever hit the States and how massive the Beatles already were in Britain and spreading into, you know, Scandinavia before they ever came to the US.
Yeah, and how it was this culmination of events that, you know, some things they could control and some things they couldn't, that resulted with them coming to America in 1964, February 7th, landing at JFK, you know, having been booked months before they even had a hit record in the States. You know, Ed Sullivan was taking this great leap of faith in the fall of 63 when he booked them, you know, not knowing whether he was booking a hit-selling act or, you know, some novelties with funny haircuts, but it just played out perfectly.
What we thought we'd start with, though, is a song that really, you know, Beatlemania, I think, was encompassed in She Loves You. You know, the catchphrase, the yeah, 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 became a kind of Beatles catchphrase early on.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And, You know, so let's play that and listen out for what I still maintain is the first time a pop or rock singer used a kind of sarcasm in the voice. Listen to John in this song about telling a guy to really get his act together with his girl. And when he says apologize to her, or he sings apologize to her, listen to the sarcasm in the voice. I think it's quite unique.
You think he ever delivered many apologies to women in his life?
Yeah, I doubt it. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, Robert, did you hear the sarcasm?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a precursor of much sarcasm we'd be hearing from John Lennon in the years to come.
Yeah. That was really a very different sound from anything we'd heard on either side of the Atlantic at that time. It's a very unique sound, isn't it? And they never... The thing back then was that often people had a hit single. The follow-up would often sound like a clone.
Yeah, absolutely. And consider what came before. You know, you had, you know, Love Me Do... 1 year earlier, you know, this sort of bluesy country western sounding thing, kind of atypical for the Beatles sound, you know, that leaps to Please Please Me, which was tremendous and really encapsulated where they were, you know, as a band, you know, this dynamic, engaging act. From Me to You, sort of a evolution moving forward of Please Please Me, but She Loves You, which followed that, is this great leap forward. Doesn't sound anything like it. No harmonica on it. It's just, you know, pure adrenaline for 2.5 minutes.
And nothing that they did after that sounded like it either.
No, it's
and
an anomaly.
It is. It's a very unique sound, isn't it, really? People now, I think it's been denigrated over the years as, oh, you know, early Beatles, it's middle-of-the-road pop. But in the context of them importing American rock and roll into the UK, doing their thing to it, and before it eventually comes back across the Atlantic, it still doesn't sound like anything else, does it? It doesn't sound like a derivative of American rock and roll, really.
No, it doesn't sound like anything that was going on in the States at that time. Which, incidentally, this was their third stateside single, issued by Swan after VJ took a pass on it, that Philadelphia label co-owned by Dick Clark. And it really didn't do anything at the time. I think it got a spin on his show, American Bandstand. Not until early 64 did it get back some traction in this country with this torrent that was unleashed with their, you know, appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show and I Want to Hold Your Hand topping the charts. And then it really got, you know, seen for what it was. I mean, if you look at what was going on in the States at the same time, you know, She Loves You was, I can't remember, was it 5 weeks or 6 weeks at number one in Britain? It was this massive single. It would retain that record for being the biggest selling single in the UK till 1978. And what knocked it off the number one slot at that point? Mull of Kintyre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I will give away my age now. I was four and a half, actually, at the time that She Loves You was number one in Britain. And I was swept up with everyone else, you know, in the tide of Beatlemania. I mean, that whole yeah, yeah, yeah catchphrase, everyone was singing that song. And you talked about the US chart. The British chart, I know it was Cliff Richard was also in there, who was like the kind of British Elvis who could never break on this side of the Atlantic.
No, couldn't get arrested.
Right. And he had his cover of It's All in the Game. And then there was Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas with Lennon McCartney original, Bad to Me.
Good song.
Yeah. And Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet with I Want to Stay Here. And I'll Never Get Over You, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates.
Ooh, they were still around. I know he had a car accident, I think, 66.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, all we ever knew from him was Shaken All Over.
Yeah.
And that was by the Guess Who, you know, doing them. Yeah, in America, at that same time, you look at what was topping the charts. It was Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton, you know, sort of this, you know, extension of the 1950s pop-wise. My Boyfriend's Back by the Angels is number two. That's another one of those girl group things from the early 60s. Peter, Paul, and Mary were having a great year that year. If I Had a Hammer, they recorded. But the one that was number three in September when She Loves You was topping the chart in Britain was by Trini Lopez, who the Beatles would share a bill with in early 64. Sally Go Round the Roses, Then He Kissed Me, Surfer Girl from the Beach Boys, who would end up being competition. So you get sort of a sense of, you know, what the American charts were like pre-Beatles British invasion.
I have to say, I don't go with the school of thought where people say, oh, before the Beatles came along, American pop was in the doldrums. I don't think that's true at all, actually. You know, you had all these fantastic Phil Spector hits. You had the Beach Boys in the ascendancy. But I think what the Beatles did do, as we were saying, with She Loves You and with all of their other material, they were just bringing something completely unique to the charts and to listeners' ears.
And they were giving it a big boost of energy. You know, it had been, you know, kind of traveling along, and, you know, the Beach Boys were doing really well that year. The Four Seasons, also on VJ, were having a great run of hits through 1963. But, you know, when the Beatles came along in early 64, again, you know, was a, I think there was a Bobby Vinton song that was number one right before I Want to Hold Your Hand knocked it off. There's like this night and day difference. I mean, some of the stuff that was topping the charts would have been stuff your parents could have been listening to.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't really belong to youth. It didn't really have that energy to it that the Beatles brought to the table.
I think that actually lasted right the way through the 60s, even when the Beatles did arrive. If you look at the pop charts from even like 67, you know, you'll see Sinatra in there.
Oh, yeah.
With, you know, the Rolling Stones.
Right, whoever. Right, yeah. Right. It had not yet become balkanized like it would later on.
Right.
Al Sussman, you guys may know as being a senior editor at Beatle Fan Magazine, has written the book called Changing Times, 101 Days That Shaped a Generation, which speaks to this actual period in the fall of 1963 through the arrival of the Beatles in 1964, and how, you know, there's a certain perception that, oh, you know, America was just totally in such a grief-stricken, sad state until the Beatles arrived to take them out of it. And really, had, you know, we not suffered this national tragedy in Dallas in the fall of 63, you know, it really was something that sort of paved the way for the Beatles arriving to sort of lift everybody's spirits. You know, it's more complex than that. And Al's going to tell you now about what was really happening in America in the pop charts and culturally.
The funny thing is that, you know, people immediately assume that the British invasion, at least musically, began in February and March of 1964. Actually, in a pop culture sense, the British invasion had begun in October of 62 when Beyond the Fringe debuted on Broadway. And that followed shortly thereafter by Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, Anthony Newley's play, and Oliver. And then in 60, during 63, the British new wave of films began to really take hold, probably led by Tom Jones. And then there were, and various other things, obviously the first James Bond film also debuted during 63. And in fact, the second film, From Russia with Love, debuted in England in the fall of 63, although it didn't make it over here until May of 64. So in a pop culture sense, the British invasion was already beginning. Musically, though, it was obviously much slower. The only sort of British hits were all pretty much novelty records or instrumentals, like the Tornado's Telstar, which was the number one song in the country when 1963 began. But mostly it was novelties like Timey Kangaroo Downsport, which was a hit by Ralph Harris, which was a hit during the summer of 63. But, you know, other than that, there was really no track record for any British acts to have any kind of a real foothold. Even Cliff Richard, who was the biggest artist of the late 50s and early 60s in England, the biggest rock artist, had no track record in this country. And musically, though, it was strange, because there are times when, for one reason or another, ballads and kind of softer records tend to dominate. And it just happened that the fall of 63 was one of those times. And unfortunately, that's kind of played into the myth that the music that followed the assassination of President Kennedy was all very sad and mellow, and that's why Dominique by the Singing Nun was the number one song in the country for the entirety of December. It's nonsense, because in fact that trend really had begun in October, you know, a full month before President Kennedy went to Texas. It just happened that it was just a time when songs like Nino Temple and April Stevens' version of Deep Purple, The Village Stompers, Washington Square, Dominique, things like that. A little bit later, in December and early January, They're Upset It Again by Bobby Vinton, which was the national number one record that I Want to Hold Your Hand dislodged. But at the same time, one of the all-time rock and roll classics, Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, was the number two song in the country, but number one in New York virtually for the entirety of December. And I've always kind of felt that the middle-aged males who predominantly ran the trade industry papers, Billboard and Cashbox, that they kind of felt that the time wasn't right for a rock and roll record to be number one. So that's why Louie Louie never reached number one nationally.
That was I'll Get You, which was the flip side of She Loves You, a song that John Lennon described as something that they set out to write as a single but kind of fell short, so it was relegated to the B-side. The performance you heard was from the British show Sunday Night at the London Palladium.
Da, 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 da. See, I still remember the theme music.
Cool. So tell us about that, seeing as how we in America had no idea what that would have been.
It was a huge variety show every Sunday night, as in the title, Sunday Night at the London Palladium. It had various hosts, but when the Beatles appeared on there, I think it was Bruce Forsyth was the guy who, I mean, he's still around on UK TV screens to this day. And that was the show that really brought Beatlemania into everyone's homes. You know,
sort of the Ed Sullivan Show of Britain.
It was, in a way, yeah. But it was, you know, in a obviously a large theater as opposed to a kind of TV theater. This was a large theater, and it was the good old-fashioned variety show. At the end, you would have what they called the Tiller Girls, sort of high kicking to the music, and everyone would be standing on this revolving podium at the end, you know. And the Beatles did that because an interesting thing about 63, it's a bit like Elvis in 56, you know. It's at the beginning of the career where they're prepared to still do the whole showbiz shtick.
Play the game,
yeah,
and the Stones weren't a few years later.
Right. And so the Beatles, there they are on this, you know, good old-fashioned variety show, basically. And there's some great photos of them in 63 doing the rounds, you know, with sort of UK's homegrown celebrities from yesteryear, you know, people from the 40s and 50s who were still around. And there are the Beatles with them, you know. And,
right.
But not something that they would be prepared to do for a whole lot longer.
Oh, no. And that came like just, what was it, like less than 2 weeks before they played the Royal Variety Show.
Yeah.
And that was like between the two events, between these two high profile shows, that really sort of codified, at least in the media and among the older generation in Britain, the success of the Beatles. That was sort of like the pinnacle to that point of consolidating all their successes. You know, they had the teenage audience. They'd had their number one, you know, Please Please Me was number one in the album charts for half a year that year. You know, Now She Loves You was a monster single. But now it's like they're no longer just this, you know, adolescent pastime. They're something bigger now.
Yeah.
And the media finally latched onto it.
Yeah, and that's something that I recently spoke about with Mark Lewison. As I'm sure everyone listening to this show knows, Mark is the author of the new book on the Beatles, All These Years, Tune In. It's the first of three volumes published by Crown in the US and Little Brown in the UK. It is really going to be the Bible for Beatle fans, the reference work. And this is what he had to say about the Beatles at the London Palladium and then the Royal Command Show.
The Beatles first experienced great fan fervour, if you like, and a real kind of possessiveness on the part of their fans in Liverpool before they became big in Britain. Essentially, the way the Beatles broke was a continual rollout of popularity. It rolled out from Liverpool into the northwest of England in the late part of 1962, and then it rolled out of Liverpool and the northwest of England into the whole of the UK during 1963, and it happened quite quickly, actually. People tend to say that the Beatlemania began in October 1963 when they appeared on the London Palladium TV show in England and then appeared before royalty in the Royal Variety Show a month later. In fact, that isn't quite right. That was when the media particularly tuned into the Beatles, but on a fan level, they were there quite a bit earlier. There's a lot of a number of reports of screams for the Beatles at the very beginning of 1963, when they're playing the little towns around the country, and indeed there have been some in Liverpool in 62.
For our last number, I'd like to ask your help. But the people in the cheaper seats, clap your hands. And the rest of you, if you just rattle your jewellery. Thank you. We'd like to sing a song called Twist and Shout.
Out.
there was a very swift accumulation of appreciation for the Beatles in their home country in 1963, but that was nothing compared to the way it broke in America, because whilst in the UK it broke, as I say, over the period of months, in America it was like a dam had built up, because America first got to read about the Beatles not because of their music, but simply because of this extraordinary phenomenon that was happening across the Atlantic. And it was a news story before it was a teenage story, if you like. And you know, there would be reports in the American press covering what was on the wire services about what was going on outside theatres in England, for example, of fans queuing for hours and screaming at the airport and all that kind of stuff. But all the same, it was building up and building up and building up. And then when eventually the Beatles had proper exposure in America for the first time, which was January 1964, it was an avalanche. It was just a complete avalanche. They very quickly rose to that same level of fever pitch, if you like, among a certain strata of American fans, primarily girls, but not entirely. Almost overnight. It all happened in the space of about 2 or 3 weeks. So that was a much more intense, much more like a crash course in Beatlemania that occurred there. And it took everyone by surprise. It took Americans by surprise. It certainly took the British by surprise, and it took the Beatles by surprise. But from that point on, American Beatle fans and British Beatle fans approached the Beatles in a slightly different way, and it was some years before parity was achieved, because of the nature of the experience of the way it had actually happened.
Yeah, it was also a phenomenon for British people to see their pop musician boys doing so well in America, wasn't it? I remember no one could really believe the money they must be earning.
Well, the context of the Beatles breaking America in their home, for those in their home country, was really, you couldn't get a more dramatic contrast. Before the Beatles, Britain's biggest pop star by far, clearly the king, was a guy called Cliff Richard. And Cliff Richard had broken big in Britain in 1958 and been particularly big from about 60, 61. But when he tried to get into America, he failed quite dismally, actually. He went there, I think, beginning of 60, and did a tour, one of those kind of Dick Clark caravan tours where loads of artists go on the road and play the theatres and do like one number and then get off. And he did one of those tours to no particular effect. And then just at the point when the Beatles were releasing their first record in Britain in October 62, at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Cliff Richard was in America again, given a fairly big push by Paramount in support of a motion picture. But it just didn't work. So no one in Britain was expecting any British talent to go to America and suddenly break the place wide open. So that was a complete shock for the British public and for the British media, that one of our acts had gone over to America and been so immensely successful. And of course it followed that those in Britain, it was expected that they must be totally coining it, that they would come back millionaires, because that was always the thing about America. It was a place full of millionaires, and everything is so much bigger there, and you would go there and earn so much more money there. And in fact, they actually did, but they weren't millionaires. But that was always what the thinking was. You know, God, they must be millionaires. As soon as they got back to England, the questions were, are you millionaires yet? Because they're broken America, and America was the land, well, the promised land, wasn't it? It was the land of milk and honey.
Yeah, because there was that TV skit with Mike and Bernie Winters in which they arrive at London Airport with their suitcases stuffed full of cash.
Yeah, that's it. They got back from America on the 22nd of February 1964. The next day, they had to make a TV show. There was no time for jet lag for the Beatles. They had actually stayed in America on that trip longer than originally scheduled. So they knew that as soon as they got back, they'd have to go and do this TV show. And a sketch had probably been rush written, I would imagine, because if they hadn't have been to America, this sketch wouldn't have actually worked. But the beginning of the TV show, the Beatles are entering the customs hall at London Airport, and they're all carrying cases, and the cases are just stuffed full of dollars. And wasn't that something to celebrate? I mean, it was just an extraordinary thing that our boys had gone to America and come back as kings. And it was amazing for the Beatles, because they had read about Cliff Richard's trips to America. They had known how hard it was to go there. They had known that no British act had ever really gone there and done this. And instead of waiting for someone else to do it, maybe one day, it turned out that it was them.
So what were the importance and true impact of the October 13th appearances on Sunday night at London Palladium and the November the 4th Royal Command performance? Although all of the Beatles' 1963 TV appearances obviously played a huge role in feeding the frenzy and making them household names, do any others particularly stand out in terms of their importance?
The true impact of the London Palladium show, first of all, on a personal level, it was held to be the pinnacle of British light entertainment. And although it wasn't necessarily what, you know, they would have thought of it this way, for one in particular, for Ringo, it was the culmination of an ambition. When he'd started out drumming in a group in 1957, a friend of the family had said, you know, one day you'll get to the London Palladium, son, and you'll see your name in lights. And it was a ludicrously unlikely proposition to make. It was probably said more as a joke than anything else. But all the same, he held that as an ambition. And then eventually he got there. In fact, he said eventually, it only took 6 years, which is pretty swift. But he got there, and he was incredibly nervous before that show. He threw up backstage. He was so nervous. They all had family in the audience. It was, if they never broke America, and of course at this point they had no idea that they would, this night could well have been looked back on as the biggest of their careers. Because it was the Beatles, it turned out to be just one of so many milestones, but it was at that time quite likely going to be the biggest thing they ever did that night. But the impact really was on the more adult viewing public. The Beatles have been on teenage TV shows all year. The pop shows like Thank You Lucky Stars and latterly Ready Steady Go. But once the newspapers started to write about them, and drew everyone's attention to this TV program, all the adults who were wondering what this thing was, they probably had never watched Thank You Lucky Stars, they probably had never watched Ready Steady Go, they tuned in just to see what it was that everyone was banging on about. So that show introduced the adult population of Britain to the Beatles, that and the Royal Variety Show. And that's the difference, really. All the shows were actually of equal importance to the Beatles in the sense of spreading the word. But those two shows in particular introduced them to a slightly different audience. And what they found, the adults, was that a lot of them like the Beatles as well, that they weren't just something for kids. A lot of adults really understood that they were something amazing and fresh and bright and interesting and funny and talented, and that it wasn't just some silly little kids thing. So that was really the impact of those shows, a bit like the Ed Sullivan Show in America. Slightly different case in as much as everybody watched that show, adults and kids alike, but all the same, a lot of adults were watching the Ed Sullivan Show, and some of them would have understood a little bit more about what it was that their kids were getting excited about. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
So that was Roll Over Beethoven from October 63 when the Beatles were in Sweden, the same tour when they basically played on the Swedish TV show Drop-In, which we still get to see these days. That was a performance in Stockholm, and the Swedes really got it, didn't they?
They did. They did. Outside of Germany and outside of Liverpool and London and in between in England, Sweden was one of the first countries to actually pick up on Beatlemania and really run with it. You know, the screaming and, you know, the adulation that would become familiar in the months to come.
And that's really a phenomenal performance, isn't it? I mean, we've got George doing the lead vocal because, you know, he was doing that on the with the Beatles album.
Right, which wasn't out yet.
Yeah, and it was the second album in the UK, same cover as Meet the Beatles in the US.
Right.
And normally it had been John doing it on stage, but they kind of gave George a larger vocal contribution for the records, and now he's doing it in this radio broadcast.
Right. Well, he did. It was George singing at the Star Club, which was recorded in December of 62. Mm. That great rough and ready performance with the extended guitar solo. Mm. You know, I don't know about you, but I love that album to death. And it's amazing the way when they tackled that song, which was so much a part of their sets from very early on, that they sort of recalibrated their approach every time they did it. You know, you listen to what they did at the Star Club, and it's just this boom, boom, powerhouse, you know, guitar grinding approach to it. You listen to what they just did here in Sweden, and Ringo especially, the guy that their producer was so unsure of, you know, back in the fall of 62, that he had a replacement ready and seated at the kit. And Ringo's just doing some amazing jazz-like fills. He's just swinging all over that track, you know, in a way that you would never hear him again. You listen to what they recorded more or less concurrently for the studio version, which was on the With the Beatles album, and it's a straightforward four on the floor, boom, boom, boom. You know, it's just, you know, very simple, very solid. And I think that was one of the things that really sold Ringo to George Martin, was he was a drummer that intuitively knew how to rethink his approach, you know, playing live versus playing in the studio. He knew the difference between how you approach something that's going to be a record versus how do you get a crowd going and drive the band.
Yeah, well, look at the footage of him at the Washington Coliseum, the Beatles' first U.S. concert in February of 64. And he is so animated. A huge difference to when you see him a couple of years later, let's say in Tokyo, when they're really looking jaded.
Right.
And he's just basically holding the beat at that point. But 64 in Washington, man, he's going for it.
Yeah, and especially I saw her standing there. It's just an amazing thing, just flogging the hell out of the cymbals.
Yeah.
Well, even concurrently to what we're just talking about now, in Sweden, the drop-in show, when they do Long Tall Sally,
yes,
with that awful audio mix where, you know, you can't hear George, but John is like way up front
right
in the mix.
Yeah.
But you see enough of Ringo, and it's like, yeah, I could see why his predecessor was let go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's no Adam beat, but it's better.
Yes.
So we have that, and really, what's most interesting about the their stay in Sweden and all the adulation that stirred was when they came back to London. And I'm not sure if it was Heathrow or what airport they were at.
Is it Heathrow?
Yeah. All the masses of people turning out to see them. You know, this is a group that's got, you know, what was four hit singles to that time. One album that's been in the charts top. Their debut album has been at the top of the charts half a year. And, you know, thousands of people there. Who else is there at the same time? Ed Sullivan.
Yeah,
he's scouting out plate spinners.
Yeah,
in Europe, you know, for his show.
Yeah.
And he sees these people as like, who's here? The Queen? The Prime Minister? You know, what are all these people here for?
Mm-hmm.
No, they wouldn't scream for the Queen.
Yeah, really. And I don't think, you know, Ed would have suspected that there was any such mania going on. I don't think he'd been reading about the Beatles or anything.
He didn't know something about the Beatles.
And that's, you know, the great thing about the Beatles story is that I've always said this, that they had the luck to back up their talent and the talent to back up their luck.
Yes.
You know, they could capitalize on every opportunity that came their way, but those opportunities came their way. I think they created their own luck, you know.
They did, but they didn't create everything. And that was why, when you think about it, here, you know, the following month, you know, Brian Epstein very much wanted to get them on America's premier talent showcase, the Ed Sullivan stage. And Ed had his curiosity piqued by seeing this crowd, you know, turning out for them like that. It's like, you know, what is so great about these guys? He hadn't heard a note of their music. I don't think he felt he needed to at that point. If they've got that kind of drawing power, he wanted them on his show. And so the following month, him and Brian hammer out an agreement where, for what was on the low end of his pay scale to appear on his show, Brian didn't care about the money as much as he cared about the exposure, which was top billing three consecutive weeks on the show. And here is Ed signing this deal. They have not even had a hit record in America to this point.
That's right. I mean, you know, there's that footage of Ed in about 73 kind of laughing up his own sleeve, you know, saying about how he got the Beatles to do these shows for $15,000. And ever after, you know, Brian Epstein got it in the neck over that. But he got them on the Ed Sullivan Show, top billing.
I mean, a win-win. Everybody got what they wanted.
Absolutely.
And you know, Ed was totally sold. He met them, got on with them as people. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but in the fall of 63, before they had a hit record, that was what set the table for what happened in February of 1964 in America.
Yeah, and, you know, as Mark Lewison was saying earlier, that, you know, people just didn't expect, the Beatles themselves didn't expect to just break America wide open the way they did. And I think in Britain, in the fall of 63, well, no one have even suspected at that point that they were going to be going over to the US. At the point when they were, there was mostly that sort of ominous feeling like, well, here we go again, you know. Mm-hmm. If the Yanks don't get it, we're then Sodom. That's what we'd have been saying in England.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as Mark said, you know, the Palladium show could have been the culmination of their career. You know, there wouldn't have been the following story if they'd end up being a Cliff Richard after that. But as we know, you know, things took on a life of their own. You know, Carol James plays I Want to Hold Your Hand in December of 1963, starts igniting the Beatlemania, forcing Capitol's hand to rush out the product that they finally deemed acceptable to get behind and push. And you know, lo and behold, they land at JFK. They've got the number one record in the country.
The other thing that's going on at the tail end of 63, of course, is, you know, EMI basically trying to find the right label for the Beatles in the US. You know, they've been going through these smaller labels because Capitol, I mean, it sounds just really strange now, doesn't it? That the parent company EMI can't get the company that it really owns, Capitol, to do its bidding for it.
No, not until Brian really forced the issue. And, yeah, you know, they reached the point of critical mass where, you know, Capitol at that point couldn't deny them any further.
But again, it's all about the timing. And even though they were, you know, obviously wanted success whenever they could get it in the States, I think the timing was just perfect. Everything just gelled. It came together.
Yes. And yeah, it would have been a nice, happy diversion for the country in the wake of their president slaying. But, you know, it was a little more complex than that. Yes, the timing was great. And, you know, one thing followed the other. You couldn't have contrived it or scripted it any better. And everything just broke their way.
Yeah. And also things were in place more than, you know, Elvis had done the first round of this, right? You know, he'd done this the previous decade. You know, he'd been massive. And, you know, now it was the business, I think, was a better geared for the Beatles as well.
Right, right. Yeah. The precedent had been set. Little man.
Okay, so I think now it's time for one of our regular features, which is drumroll.
Questions from listeners.
But we don't have any listeners.
No.
This is our first show.
to get technical, yeah, okay.
So where did you get your question from?
Well, okay, we cheated. Actually, on my Facebook page, which is Fab4Fact 2.0, I threw it out there. If anybody wanted to ask a Beatle-related question of me or a Brit, I had one at hand.
Of English persuasion.
Of the English persuasion, yes, which you filled the boots perfectly.
Thank you.
We drew a question that we liked from one James Paul, who wanted to know, what was the deal with the Beatles writing a song for the Rolling Stones?
I don't think they actually wrote it for the Stones. They were talking about I Want to Be Your Man.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't write it for them per se. But it's interesting because, you know, in later years, how they would be sort of marketed as the anti-Beatles, the Rolling Stones would. And, you know, like these you know, serious rivals, you know, they were nothing of the sort. They were actually friends. And in fact, it was George who had helped get them their deal with Decca.
Yeah, actually with Dick Rowe.
Right, the guy who is blamed for turning down the Beatles, even though it was really his underling that actually made the call and was there that day. But anyway, yeah, I mean, the Beatles had seen the Stones at the Crawdaddy Club in London, and they liked them. And George was, you know, generous enough to put the word out to Decca, who then signed them. And in early summer of 63, they put out their first single, which was a cover of Chuck Berry's Come On. You know, it did okay, not great. And they were looking for a follow-up.
And it's, you know, important to say that they were very much an R&B group. And,
yes.
You know, so that's what they were looking for as well, was that style.
Right, exactly. And they had apparently went into the studio and recorded Poison Ivy and Fortune Teller, which was going to be their second single. And that got canceled. It was supposed to be in August of 63, I believe. And it so happened that Andrew Oldham, who was managing the Rolling Stones, had worked for Brian Epstein for a short time and had got to see close up what it was like to operate on that high level, you know, of, you know, selling records and fan adulation and how the business worked. And he recognized that, you know, to really get a worthwhile revenue stream going, songwriting was where it was at. And Mick and Keith were not ready to assume that role just yet. And so he happened to bump into John and Paul in the street or in a club or something like that, you know, knew them from having worked with them before, and used the opportunity to kind of take them inside and say, hey, got any spare songs laying around?
Yeah, and I think they had like a last verse that they had to knock out, and they said, well, hold on a second. They went into another room and, you know, came back just a few minutes later and said, okay, done. And Mick and Keith were absolutely blown away by this.
Yeah, this is how songwriting's done, just like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, what they were offering up, as John would say later, you know, they weren't going to give the Stones any A material. So they gave them what they had already sketched out as being Ringo's vocal track on their upcoming With the Beatles album, which was I Want to Be Your Man.
Well, you're saying it wasn't A material, so they were just giving Ringo the leftovers or something.
Yeah,
or...
I mean, what was already sort of earmarked for Ringo was perfect for the Rolling Stones. Wouldn't pose a threat whatsoever.
And of course, the Stones, again, as I said, they did it in their R&B style. It had a very different feel to the Beatles.
Oh, absolutely. It's great. Slide guitar from Brian Jones on that, and this pulsating bass line from Bill Wyman. It was a very different animal. I mean, you know, with the Beatles version, Ringo singing, it works. I mean, my favorite experience of that song is where you hear it in A Hard Day's Night in a dance club sequence.
Yes.
They're dancing to it. Yeah. But, I mean, the Stones had a lot
riding. So in other words, you're saying you prefer it as background music, Robert?
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much. Yeah, as long as there's a visual going along with it. I think it's kind of hilarious if you have any familiarity with the live versions the Beatles did on tour in 65 when, you know, they would swing Ringo's mic over to him to sing into that was otherwise miking his drums, and they would just kind of plow through it to give Ringo his little share of the spotlight. But the Stones had a lot more riding on it, and they did a tremendous job.
So actually what we're going to play for you now is a little bit of the Stones version and segueing into the Beatles version with Ringo on lead vocal.
Right.
So
So that was I Wanna Be Your Man by the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and markedly different versions.
Yes, total R&B take versus a straight pop rock take, sung by Ringo.
And continuing with the theme of variety, our next show will feature Mark Lewisohn, part two of his interview, talking about his new book, All These Years, Tune In.
And we will also be covering the career and music of John Lennon, as it is his birthday month, October, in and out of the Beatles, and obviously lots to talk about there.
And also a sort of humorous angle on their first Christmas record, the 1963 Christmas record, which I believe they taped that October, didn't they?
They did, yeah. Going back to the 50-year anniversary of things, the very first Christmas record, which was taped in October of 1963.
Well, it's been fun, and we'll be speaking to you soon.
Take care.
Something About the Beatles, produced by Thomas Rapetney at Strad Studio, executive producer Rick Way.
So, tell me about last night.
Well, it wasn't what I expected. It had the perfect amount of spice.
Sounds hot.
It had all the flavor, and I wanted more. The ghost pepper wings from Popeyes are just so delicious.
Wait, I thought you were talking about your date.
Sometimes, things aren't always as they seem. Like Popeyes ghost pepper wings that have the perfect level of kick and flavor. Try them for only $5 today. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants. Price may vary. Tax extra.
Love that chicken from Popeyes.
The regular season is heating up, new stars are emerging, and that means more opportunities to win up to 25 times your cash on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection on a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's that easy. Let it fly to turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Watch your favorite players and get paid doing it this basketball season. See your entries make progress during the game or make new entries for the second half and the fourth quarter. Three-pointers, assists, rebounds, and everything in between are yours for the taking. Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit of up to $100. Just download the Prize Picks app and use code GET100. That's code GET100 on Prize Picks for a first deposit match of up to $100. Prize Picks. Pick more, pick less. It's that easy.